Well, thank you for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
And thank you for joining this edition of Rattling the Bars.
I wish I could tell him that I love him. I wish I could tell them that I love them, that we love them, but how could they believe us when they are caught between the enemy's prison systems and their own family's criticism? No one to counsel nor console. Where does a young tortured soul find its home? When they are molested for being too young and punished for getting grown, our love for them is so conditional. Our love for them is too conditional. But the condition is not conducive to our condemnation, picking at the faults like vultures, consuming the scattered leftovers once the beast has had his fill. Our sons emasculated and consequently overcompensating, and unbeknownst to them, they are just waiting for you to say, I love you. Not I love you but, not I love you if. When love is missed, love turns to myth. So why break your heart waiting for a myth? Why break your heart waiting for something that doesn't exist? Our love for them is so conditional. Our love for them is too conditional. I wish I could just tell them that we love them. I'm alive. I'm a lie. But I deserve to die for the things I've said, for the times I've lied. But they lied when they said time flies. Time floats aimlessly and then time dies. A broken winged bird, a slave to gravity. A broken winged bird, a slave to reality. I'm alive, but I deserve to die for the souls I've stolen. Bodies broken, the hearts of my close kin crushed by my carelessness. But my family tree has been uprooted, and the broken branches of broken marriages leave me out on a limb that can barely support its own weight. Like I can barely support my own kids, like I can barely keep my own crib. Ain't never had a piece of the pie, just pieces of crust that don't stick to the ribs, and I'm hungry again. Ain't nobody fed us since we were kids. So by the time he got hair on his chin, he had his ear to the street. By the time he had hair on his cheeks, he was carrying heat. By the time he got some bass in his voice box, he had rocks in his socks. Never played Pop Warner, but wrote recklessly and Pop Willie in the potholes and pitfalls of West Side Avenues. I'm dead. I'm a lie. But he deserves to be alive. I should be the one to die for the promises I've broken. He was just searching the streets for a martyr token that would take him anywhere. Northbound platform towards elsewhere. The subterranean transit terminal we figured could be like Cinderella's pumpkin. Like Aladdin's carpet. Like Jay-Z's Cooper Shaq's truck. Cash, bucks, cake, cream, money, bread, flow, green. Do you blame the dreamer or the dream? The trap or the fiend, the parent or the teen. Even when I used to tell him that we came from kings, he gonna ask me if you ever seen a king with no bling. He said if we're royalty then we have got to shine, and if I gotta shine then I've got to grind, and if I've gotta grind then never mind all that extra you're talking. Unless these shoes you walked in, or unless your chest my heart's in, unless you can guarantee that you'll hold my hand when it's dark and cold and hard and lonely and hungry, then you can't hear me, see me, be me, feel me, touch me, hug me, hold me, scold me, teach me, love me, be me. We see you, young brothers, caught on the hustle. Although you don't see it, just know that we love you. You're young, strong, and brave, and you were born for the struggle. Forgive us for our negligence, know that we love you. We see you, young brothers, and you're caught in a hustle. I know you don't see it, but know that we love you. You're young, strong, and brave, and you were born for the struggle. Forgive us for our negligence, know that we love you. We see you out there, know that we love you. We see you in the prisons, know that we love you. We see you on those corners, know that we love you. We see you in those streets, know that we love you. We see you in them juvies, know that we love you. We see you on the battlefield, know that we love you. We see you struggling, we see you hustling. We see you love, and know that we love you.
Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM, CFRU. That was Amir Suleiman, an African-American poet, with his poem Brother. My favorite poems ever, really. And, of course, we had the report on the Real News Network about the prison strike currently going on against insufferable conditions in the prisons in Florida. Now, I've been talking a lot about Eddie Conway and former political prisoner in America. Spent 46 years in prison, basically for being a member of the Black Panther Party, leading member of the Black Panther Party. And interestingly enough, like, he got out of jail, I think, about like 2014, and came back to Baltimore, which of course is where he's from. And of course, the Real News Network is actually based in Baltimore, and they actually he has a job there now as a producer. Like, he's the executive producer there now, and that's like where he works. He's like this old man now, but he's still, you know, in any way he can, he's still struggling for the rights of his people. You know, in defense of his people against the kind of abuses that they suffer. You know, and he's still doing that even though he's an old man. He's still, you know, engaged. You know, he's still struggling. And I want to play another talk by him, you know, just because I think it's very powerful what he says in this particular 20-minute interview, which he did on The Real News in 2014, not long after he got out of prison, finally, you know, after like almost 5 decades behind bars. And, you know, he did a series of interviews on The Real News and, you know, and there really was not a lot of analysis in what he said, because, of course, he understands, like, how capitalism works in America. He understands how imperialism is part of that, how racism is part of that. And, you know, his analysis is very, very good, and it's quite powerful, like, what he says. So I'm going to play this right now. This is Eddie Conway speaking on The Real News in 2014. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
Welcome to the Real News Network. I'm Paul Jay, and welcome to Reality Asserts Itself. It's just a day after the Ferguson grand jury declined to indict the officer that shot Michael Brown. The jury process itself, as many people have commented on, was extremely secretive. It was a choice of the prosecutor to do this. But the decision-making of the grand jury is not really known. We don't know the process they went through. We do know from the press conference that every possible stereotype of a black man was portrayed in the delivery of the prosecutor. We're told Michael Brown moved towards the officer. We're not given any detail in that press conference, at least, what that movement towards the officer was. It just evokes a black man moving towards you is threatening. If there'd been a trial, even a legitimate preliminary hearing, where this information could have come out, people at least could have had some transparency. Right now, it just plays on rather evocative and essentially racist imagery. This has nothing to do with the actual innocence or guilt of this officer. I don't know. I haven't seen all the evidence. I don't know all the process and what happened that day. And isn't that the point? We don't really know. And an extraordinary use of the grand jury covered all of this up. So why? Well, we're not going to get into the detail of all this. What we're really going to do is pick up on our Reality Asserts Itself series with Eddie Conway and try to talk about some of the underlying issues here. So joining us now in the studio is Eddie Conway. He's a former Black Panther. He's the author of Martial Law, Life and Times of a Baltimore Black Panther. He's now a producer at the Real News Network. Thanks for joining us.
Okay, thanks for having me.
I mean, one of the main themes in your book was your decision early on to defend your humanity, that the prison system, part of what it does is try to grind down your humanity, kind of turn you into an animal that will then be herded by guards. But that's true outside of prison too, is it not? This link of racist ideology and dehumanization, and we as a society or those who benefit from it, we dehumanize those who we want to super exploit.
Yes, and just to step back a minute to look at the prison experience, what we found was that in order for the guards to have authority, they have to continue to make efforts to dehumanize every person they see in the population. And toward that end, in the prison system, they took away all of our personal clothes and they put us in uniform. They took away the ability for us to put on oils, to smell nice, to be able to walk around with an individual identity. And in the mess hall, in particular, is one of the places where they constantly reinforce the authority of the correctional officers. Say a guy is 18 years old, he just finished high school, he gets hired by the state, it's a good job, it's job security, and he comes into the prison system, and the prison system has thousands of guys in there, some 70, some 60, some 50, but a lot of seasoned kind of people, and then he's got to have the authority to say, go over there, do this, do that. And the way they do it is they reinforce that authority by having him challenge your humanity. And so that same process takes place out in the community, and it's just strange. Last night, I rode past several young men sitting on the side of the street with their handcuffs, with their hands cuffed behind their back, and a police standing over them and another police talking. And it is stuff like that that constantly reinforce the authority. And it also dehumanizes the population, because at some point you become so dehumanized, you find ways in which to make the authorities happy, like hands up, say, or I'm slowly reaching for my wallet, and other kind of indications that makes you assert yourself to help them abuse you.
This goes right back to slavery. The elimination of individual identity, if I understand it correctly, it was illegal to read, to learn how to read. It was illegal to teach a slave to read. The idea of having a conscious, being a fully conscious human, it seems to me that the dehumanization is on two sides. One, you need society to dehumanize people that you want to super exploit, whether it's slavery or something akin to slavery. Certainly mass incarceration is pretty close to straightforward slavery. And then low wage, massive low wage section of the population, mostly black and people of color, another form of super exploitation. But also in terms of the exploiter, in terms of their own head. Somehow you can rationalize this, because these are really subhuman people. So, you know, I can do this without not, you know, and still feel good about who I am, and I'm still going to believe in God and go to heaven. The underpinnings of it is the society still wants a super exploited section of the population.
Yes, obviously the people that are benefiting from that kind of arrangement, whether you're talking about slavery or the multinational corporations today, their bottom line is profit, and their secondary concern is security. They want to be secure in their particular domains. They want to have their stuff secured so that the people that are at the bottom of the rim, that's unemployed or underemployed or that's hungry, that live in dilapidated housing, those people always have a certain amount of frustration in them anyway. They grow up in an environment, and they grow up in an environment where they see people fighting over crumbs. And all too often, they look toward where there is money, where there's power, and they might strike out. And even when they don't strike out at the money or the power, they might strike out at other ethnic groups because of the association of that the symbolism they recognize, right? It's then one of the tasks of the guardians of society to find out who in that particular community might represent a threat, who might organize, who might be emboldened and stand up or speak out against somebody. So there's a constant level of across-the-board harassment to see who will respond. And then once that person responds, that person has a resisting arrest or failure to obey an order, that person goes into the prison system, that person is labeled. Then from then on in, that person loses his right to vote,
but also that person is identified the next time there's an encounter. But it's those encounters that are primarily for the community to see, okay, see what happens to the outspoken person, see what happens if you stand up, now look at what happened to this person, and you shouldn't stand up.
It seems to me it's like what you're saying in the prison, like the guard needs to establish the authority. Well, the authority is based on fear. Mm-hmm. You need to fear, and part of that dehumanization is to abject fear of the authority figure. Well, it seems to me that's what the cops are doing on the beat. Like they're harassing, they're pushing, they're prodding, it's stop and frisk, it's beatings, because you need to accept our authority even if we're not going to charge you, if we're not going to arrest you. You just have to be afraid of us because, mm-hmm. you know, society wants, through the police, and I say the elites who run it, but not only. There's a lot of people who kind of want this outside of just the elites. They want people to internalize this fear so they don't act out. And then if you want your police force to be the hammer, you got to back them up, which means you go to extraordinary means like this grand jury, because you don't want the cops second-guessing the use of force. You want them to be the hammer and not to be afraid of being the hammer. And you go to extraordinary means to protect them when they are the hammer.
Yes, one of the things that you see that constantly happens in the community is that the level of harassment is on a very petty level. A lot of people think because of the violence in the community that most people are locked up or associated with violence. I think nationally that's like only 10% of the people that get arrested. The other 90% are actually locked up for either small amounts of marijuana or either resisting arrest or either a loitering in the area. And it is nonviolent offenses that make up maybe 90% of the prison populations in America. And that's directly related to harassment. And take into consideration that 13% of the population is black, maybe 25% of the population is people of color, but over 75% of the people in the prison system are people of color. So it is this constant petty harassment, but it's also something else. It dehumanizes or desensitizes the police that's reinforcing that, because they tend to look at the situation as if they're in enemy territory. And so anything goes in enemy territory. We've seen that in Vietnam. You see that in all similar war-type situations. They look at the poor communities, both white and black, as a hostile war zone. And they act accordingly, and they're constantly trying to weed out who might be a potential problem later on, because their mandate is to protect the property and the wealth of the elite.
Yeah, I think the economic piece is the piece that never gets talked about in mainstream media. You know, you can hear talk about racism and racist ideology and white supremacy, but it's, and at least in mainstream media, very rarely linked to this system wants a massive pool of unemployed people because they put pressure on wages. But within the pool of unemployed people, you have a segment that are super exploited, either unemployed or willing to take jobs at the lowest end of the pay scale. And those are mostly people of color, whether they're African-American or Latino. It's an enormous, I hate to put it this way, but it's like a competitive advantage for the United States. And they use this. And this racism, the police suppression, you know, when people are living in poverty, they act out, as you said. So either you have to transform those conditions or you put the hammer to put the lid on it. And the racist ideology supports the strategy of put a lid on it.
Yes, and one of the things is the American population is only 5% of the world's population, but you have 25% of the people held in prisons and in captivity in the world here in America. And so it's always the arrangement that they have in terms of economics. Not only is the profit motive the bottom line, but the fact is that they need to keep as many unemployed people in a different environment. One of the things that happened as they deindustrialized was they then there was an expansion and a boom in the prison industrial complex. 10 years before that happened, communities were like, not in my neighborhood. Don't put a prison here. Don't do this. Don't do that. But then the factories left, and all of a sudden the communities were saying, well, we'll give you tax incentive. We'll do this. We'll make sure that there's 80% of capacity in the prisons, et cetera. And so all of that kind of like works together to continue the elite's profit making. Because now what they do is, or what they have done, is they have used certain segments of the population to incarcerate prison and hold people in captivity, and they use other parts of the population to fill up those prisons and to fill up those cells. At the same time, they continue to make enormous profits, but they've created something else, divide and conquer. You know, white people can't work with black people, or the urban youth is in hostile territory when he's in Hagerstown. So then he ends up with a certain mindset. The guards in Hagerstown or Cumberland or other rural areas has a certain mindset because they're constantly in clashes with the population that's black. And so it distracts everybody from what's really going on. Both groups of people are being exploited. And are being super exploited, but we can't organize and we can't get together and look at the common cause of our problem because we're right there in each other's face.
Which is why the defense of the police by the state apparatus, by the whole media complex, by the elites, they have to defend the police and not allow, for example, civilian review of the police that would have real authority, you know, hire and fire the chief, hire and fire cops, simply make force used beyond reasonable force illegal and charge cops and send them to jail. If you start doing that, you start undermining this coercive authority you have that enforces these social conditions. And racism kind of underlies it all. Oh, because the black man's a threat, so we're all going to turn the other way when we know this mass incarceration and such is taking place.
Yeah, and another thing that should be pointed out is that sometimes you have black officers, sometimes you have Latino officers. They're just as aggressive and just as committed to suppressing people in the poor communities as the white officers are. And it's a mindset that's created by what I would call white supremacy. And it's also a mindset that is covered by institutional racism. Even black guards look into the community, or black officers look into the community, and see the community as a threat. And because in most cases they have arrived, they have moved out in suburbia, and they see the community decay.
But even if there even is some truth to it, in the, in the sense that, of course, in impoverished areas, there's higher crime than in areas where people are not impoverished. But, you know, but the cops are certainly not encouraged to ask why, and they take it as a given. And I guess it's, you know, cops need to start thinking about what the heck they're doing here and the why of why they're facing this kind of violence in the streets. Because for sure they are facing, you know, going to poor areas of Baltimore or anywhere in the world, you're going to find higher levels of violence than in areas that aren't poor.
You know what the problem is? Socialization. I mean, until you can figure a way to control the education in the community. I mean, obviously the problem's economic, but early on young people are socialized to see society in a certain light. In my generation, we were socialized to see the military as a very good thing and a possibility of advancing for us as black people and poor people, right? So we were constantly given little military toys, soldiers. The cartoons were like military, G.I. Joe, et cetera. That's reinforced, and then it's reinforced in the school by what you don't learn about yourself or what you don't learn about America. And so you get the impression that you're doing a good deed in the name of something that's really good. And so then you have that mentality there. And so it's impossible for you to look into the community and see 15 or 20 people hovering around a neighborhood and not think that they're dehumans, or they're diminished in some capacity, or they're not using all of their God-given resources to change their condition.
And essentially, it's their fault they're living in these conditions. And
blaming the victim.
So now that it's their fault, we can use the force to control them, because if they did better, they'd be out of it. It's got nothing to do with the way society is organized. Okay, join us for the next segment of our series of interviews on Reality Asserts Itself with Eddie Conway. As I mentioned early on, Eddie is now a producer at the Real News Network. And in the next segment of the series, I'm going to ask him, why is he at the Real News Network? So please join us for that.
Promised I would rap like a superstar rap. Spit like a monster, put myself on the map. First rap in English, then rap in Spanish. Que lo que tú dices, boy, I cause damage. International, worldwide, resistance in my lyrics. Walking down these mean streets to the house of spirits. Yo represento lo que canto mis canciones. Amor, justicia, hip hop, revoluciones. Listen here, we done preaching to the choir. We stayed on the block, took the neighborhood higher. I guess I just listened to the little voice speaking. The one that said, never deny what you're seeking. It made me a believer, que todo es posible. Mi flow como la lucha, siempre sigue. They call it ADD when you wildin' and don't listen. They make you think you're crazy if you question they system.
Crazy, cause I look different than you. Spark fear at the corner, your peripheral.
Call me crazy,
like I'm the violent one. Living in the empire that was born off the gun.
Now that's crazy.
What I'm supposed to do when they shut the stores down and there ain't no food?
Now that's crazy,
like I'm the violent one. Living in the empire that was born off the gun.
Call me crazy.
Crazy is as crazy does. Attack the industry with a chainsaw for a crazy buzz. What's crazy is 250 for a fare. Trying to get iced out, but there's snow everywhere. Yeah, a cold world we living in. Old girl, pimp and Kim. General soul, minus the boneless chicken and the soulless victims. Homeless conditions. Why fight my brother when I could beat the system? I write 16s in 16 minutes.
Impossible.
That's what it is, but I know what isn't. Crazy, the words Garvey spoke. Same slang as Malcolm, man. There's too many quotes. The wolf licking the blade, thinking it's Kool-Aid. Bloodthirsty, turning out cells into slaves. What's crazy is you in a gang, but won't do a goddamn thing when the police bang on the corners. We learn how to hang with no more nooses, just mad trees. The same old thing. What's crazy is how they control our brain. The demonic songs that the radio play. You a revolutionary? Yeah, it's all good. But they don't know you in the hood. What's good? That's crazy. And I don't got no time to look it. Crazy, my straight jacket on crooked.
Now that's crazy,
cause I look different than you. Spark fear at the corner, your peripheral.
Call me crazy,
like I'm the violent one. Living in the empire that was born off the gun.
Now that's crazy.
What I'm supposed to do when they shut the stores down and there ain't no food?
Now that's crazy,
like I'm the violent one. Living in the empire that was born off the gun.
Call me crazy,
like I lost my marbles. Like all I wanna do is criticize and argue. Like my screws loose, cause I say what I want to. Shit, say what I got to. Es por eso que canto. Queremos un cambio, en eso andamos. Yo creo caminos, no creo en obstáculos. You say I'm loco and need a doctor. I say let's be realistic and do the impossible. Check it out, I'm on a higher plane. Some say it ain't sane, I say it's okay. Let your mind sway, ride the wave. Better that than on land and stuck in one place. They want you sedated, drugged and medicated. More paper in the pockets of the drug fabricators. All indicators show our society sick. Disease by greed, that's the diagnosis.
Now that's crazy,
cause I look different than you. Spark fear at the corner, your peripheral.
Call me crazy,
like I'm the violent one. Living in the empire that was born off the gun.
Now that's crazy,
what I'm supposed to do when they shut the stores down and there ain't no food?
Now that's crazy,
like I'm the violent one. Living in the empire that was born off the gun.
Call me crazy.
You people are crazy!
Back in the USSR, we'll be back after this short break.
You're listening to CFRU 93.3 FM in Guelph, Ontario. Guelph, Ontario.
autumn breezes induce a nostalgic mood when four former high school friends return to their hometown for a wedding. Now 40, they seize the opportunity for a boisterous reunion in a boathouse apartment where they partied in the past. Absurd antics and mistaken assumptions may suggest light domestic comedy, but a closer look unearths darker shades. Don't miss out on the Guelph Little Theatre's production of Gloria's Guy, written by Joan Burrows. This production is also the Guelph Little Theatre's Western Ontario Drama League entry, taking place every Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday from January 26th to February 10th. Tickets are only $22, and you can pick them up by calling 519-821-0270 or visiting guelphlittletheatre.com. Don't miss out on Gloria's Guy at the Guelph Little Theatre, 176 Morris Street, a physically accessible location.
Hey, how you doing? My radio name is Mac D, and I've been hanging around CFRU for a long, long time. Because it's fun. I started off working the equipment, producing shows, and then moved into doing my own show. Along the way, I've learned about local artists and their music, and other artists and music I never would have heard of or listened to before. I'm still here, still doing shows, still having fun. If what I do sounds like something you'd enjoy, visit us on the second floor of the University Center and find out what CFRU has to offer you.
Hey, have you heard about the upcoming free writing workshops at the University of Guelph?
No, what's going on?
It's the U of Guelph's Writers Workshop, a two-day event in the McLaughlin Library, where writing experts provide workshops on tons of different areas of writing. Creative writing, nonfiction, publishing, playwriting. There really is something for everyone.
Can anyone attend?
Yeah, it's free for students, faculty, and community members. It's a physically accessible venue, and the workshops are designed for writers of all skill levels.
That sounds amazing. And it's free? I could use some tips on grammar and accessible language, or better yet, for restructuring my latest short story.
I hear that registration is already filling up, so we should check out the website at lib.uoguelph.ca and choose our sessions today so we don't miss out.
Register for individual sessions at the Free Writers Workshop 2018 taking place Saturday, March 3rd and Sunday, March 4th at the University of Guelph. Come for one session or for as many sessions as you like. There's something for everyone.
Listen to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. So like I said at the beginning of the show, this is just the beginning of a series of shows I'm going to do on Black History Month here on Back in the USSR. So stay tuned for the for more programming on that. But what I want to do now is I want to round off the show with a if you remember, like a few years ago, I did actually interview Brendan Campisi of the Young Communist League and about the Black Liberation Struggle, particularly concerning the Black Panther Party. And during the 1960s, which of course, that was a struggle Eddie Conway played an intimate part in, and indeed like suffered the repercussions of that. Like he was persecuted because of that, as many of his comrades were. So once again, to kind of give the context of that, I mean we've only got like less than half an hour, but I think I can cover quite a bit of it. I'm gonna play the interview which I did with Brendan, which covers a lot of this history of the radical liberation struggle of African Americans during those years, which of course still has repercussions now. So I'm going to play that. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
Now out of this.
To 5 p.m. each day, student bursaries are available. Not wheelchair accessible.
Explain to you, Brother Huey P. Newton.
Not wheelchair accessible.
You're listening to Back in the USSR.
Explain to you who Brother Huey P. Newton is in his soul. I got to explain to you also your soul, your needs, your political desires and needs, because that is Huey's soul. When we first organized the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense, he would say, Bobby, he says, we're going to draw up a basic platform, just basic, that black people can read. He says, We don't want to go real elaborate with all these essays and dissertations and all this stuff, because the brother gonna look at that and he say, man, I ain't got time for that. I gotta go see what I can do for myself. It's just a basic platform that the mothers who struggle hard to raise us, that the fathers who worked hard, that the young brothers in school who come out of school semi-illiterate. You say we want freedom, we want power to determine the destiny of our black community, full employment for our people. Number three, we want housing fit, decent housing fit for shelter of human beings. Number four, we want all black men to be exempt from military service. Number five, we want decent education for our black people in our community that teaches us the true nature of this decadent racist society, and to teach black people and our young black brothers and sisters their place in society, because if they don't know their place in society and in the world, they can't relate to anything else. Number six, we want an end to the robbery by the white racist businessmen of black people and black people in their community. Number seven, we want an immediate end to police brutality and murder of black people. They have not had a fair trial because they've been tried by all white juries, and that's just like being tried in Germany being a Jew. Number eight, we want black people, number nine, when brought to trial, to be tried by members of their peers, and a peer being one who comes from the same economic, social, religious, historical, and racial background. If the United States government and the courts and the local courts did this, they would have to choose black people from the black community to sit up on the jury. They'd have to choose some of the mothers who've been working 20 years in Miss Ann's kitchen scrubbing floors like my mother had done. They have to choose some of them hardworking fathers. They have to choose some of those brothers who stand on the block out there wondering where they're going to get a gig. They're going to have to choose these black people. And number 10, he would say, let's just summarize it. We want housing, we want clothing, we want education, we want justice, and we want peace. This is the basic platform. In case you never knew it or not, of all the things that you've heard in the press, of all the derogatory statements that's been made in the press about Brother Huey P. Newton and I, of all these derogatory statements to guide you away from seeing this basic platform that Huey was talking about for his own people. We have to learn to look through the white press. We have to learn to see what's going on. Now, out of this platform, Huey P. Newton realized that it was necessary for us to start working on these points, these 10 points, practically. Remember number seven? We want an immediate end to police brutality and murder of black people. This is very, very important. And here, whether you know it or not, it's where you start dealing with the black revolution. When Huey says, every black man put a shotgun in your home. And once we let the man know, say, look, we armed from block to block, and we're going to patrol you from our windows. And we're not going to have you brutalizing none of our people in the streets. Do you realize what kind of power black people have then? Because you begin to neutralize that police force, because them cops going to start riding shaky and scared. In fact, we're in a position then to demand that they withdraw from our community, because they occupy our community just like a foreign troop occupies territory. Very important to understand. We hate cops beating black people over their heads and murdering them. That's what we hate. If you got enough energy to sit down and hate a white person just because of the color of his skin, you waste a lot of energy. You better take that same energy and put it in some motion out there and start dealing with those oppressive conditions, and you're going to find out just what you hate and what you're going to stop. Racism, you dig it? When you stop racism, you stop brutality and murder of black people by the racist occupying army in our black community. That's what we're going to stop. What's being done to us? You dig it? Can you dig the white power structure and this racist police force and how they've escalated the situation? That before Watts, there was 1,300 cops. Now there's 6,000 cops patrolling black people. That in Oakland, they had 350 cops just 3.5 years ago. Now they got 1,000 cops patrolling black people. San Francisco's double its police force. And every area, major metropolis where black people live all across this country, they've doubled, tripled, and quadrupled their police force, equipped them with tanks, all kinds. We got to stop it, brother. Let's get together and unify.
Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU, I'm Siegfried, and I never get tired of playing that clip from Bobby Seale talking about the Black Panther Party's 10-point program. I know I've played it on this show again and again, many, many times. Many times at the intro for the show, and just it's never inappropriate to play the 10-point platform of the Black Panther Party. Like it's still absolutely relevant to this day. Of course, I've talked many, many times about what happened, of course, in Ferguson last year, and of course, the ongoing protests, Black Lives Matter, and the ongoing struggles of African Americans against the racist, you know, settler state, capitalist state in America, and how that goes on. You know, it's just as relevant as it was in the 1960s, that speech. So, it being the last day, and certainly it went by way too fast, the last day of Black History Month, I decided I would be talking about the Black Panther Party and the kind of impact that it had on the African-American struggle for liberation, like in the United States, and the impact it had like on not only on the African-Americans, but also on, you know, other oppressed communities in the United States, and even on like poor working class white people, as I was quite surprised to find out myself, and also the impact it had internationally, you know, The Black Panthers certainly punched far above their weight, you know, and their influence is still felt to this day. So I thought I would bring somebody who is very knowledgeable on this particular subject in the studio to talk with me today. So I brought in a comrade from the Young Communist League. I brought in Brendan Campisi, who has been on the show before. It's been a while, I believe, Brendan. You were talking to Patrick last year while I was in China. About Gabriel Kolkol, and the last time I think you remember, you were talking about the Korean War and the lead up to the Korean War and the Korean people's struggle for liberation against Japan and then ultimately against America.
So, yeah, that sounds about right. It's good to be back here. It's always good to be here on Back in the USSR.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's good to have you back. So just to kind of give, maybe you could kind of just originally put it in context, how did the Black Panther Party emerge in the first place? Because, of course, we hear a lot, about, especially with movies like Selma recently coming out, and, you know, you hear a lot about, of course, Martin Luther King and the kind of the original protest in the civil rights movement and this sort of thing. We basically are told, but we're only told that, like, definitely one side of the story.
Yeah.
You know, we're not told about the emergence of the Black Panther Party and the kind of context that it emerged from. So maybe you could kind of elaborate on that.
That's a very good point. Hollywood doesn't really make movies about the Black Panther Party. The Black Panthers are in Forrest Gump, if I recall. And it's been a long time since I've seen that, but they're definitely not portrayed in any kind of positive way in what is a profoundly conservative film. But, yeah, it's a good question talking about where the Black Panther Party comes from. So the context for the emergence of the Black Panther Party is marked by a couple of things. As you said, this is the moment of the civil rights movement, or the moment after, in some ways, the civil rights movement. I'm going to challenge a bit of the framing of that in a second. But it's also the moment of decolonization. Mm-hmm. It's the moment of third world liberation struggles. It's the moment of the struggle of the people of Vietnam against the U.S. intervention and the puppet state in South Vietnam. Those are the two sort of fundamental conditions for the emergence of the Black Panther Party. And the Black Panther Party itself is founded in Oakland in 1966 by two community college students, Huey Newton and Bobby Seale. But there's a bit of – and then it spends the next couple of years of its life mostly as a small local group in Oakland. Later, there's a chapter in Los Angeles. And it's not until the spring of 1968 after the assassination of Martin Luther King that it expands across the country. But before I talk about that, I'm going to talk a little bit about the ideological and political prehistory of the Black Panther Party. And to do that, I'm mostly going to talk about Malcolm X and the impact that Malcolm X had.
Right.
So, as you mentioned, the civil rights movement, as it's commonly conceived, takes place in the early, in the late 1950s and early 1960s. And there is this incredible mobilization of the African-American people, mostly in the South, but also outside, and of white allies, for basically for legal equality and the end of legal segregation in the United States. And that's led by Martin Luther King and by mostly Christian reformist political forces. And then in 1964-65, the Civil Rights Act is signed, the Voting Rights Act is signed, legal segregation in the South begins to be dismantled. It actually takes a bit longer. It's not as if it just disappears in 1965.
Oh, yeah.
But legal segregation, formal segregation, begins to be dismantled. So the terrain of the struggle shifts a bit. It's worth noting that people participating in this movement didn't really call it the Civil Rights Movement very much, especially not at the grassroots. What they called it was the Freedom Movement.
Mm.
And the grassroots people, the farmers and workers in the South, Black farmers and workers in the South who were the backbone of the movement, didn't think of it as a movement just for the end of legal segregation. They called it the Freedom Movement, and freedom meant many of the kinds of things that Bobby Seale talks about in that clip. It means many things that were mentioned in the Black Panther Party program. It includes these economic demands. So the movement itself is kind of misunderstood. But in any case, a particular phase of that struggle does end in 1965. And then another set of issues comes to the fore, issues that are not so much the issues specifically of Black people in the South who've been living under formal segregation, but the issues of the millions of African Americans living in these large urban concentrations outside the South that have been created over the past few decades, the previous few decades, by the mass migration out of the South in places like Los Angeles and Oakland on the West Coast and in places like Detroit and Chicago and Gary and Newark and Harlem and Boston in the Northeast and the Great Lakes, basically. And that's the environment that the Black Panther Party will emerge out of. And so there's a new set of concerns. Police brutality is one of them. Unemployment is one of them. Those are probably the two most explosive issues. And from 1964 onward, there's this series of urban rebellions that start – the first prominent one is in Watts in Los Angeles in 1965 or 64. And this continues into the early 1970s. And so there's this very, very clear sign that there's this rage building that's been building up for a long, long time in these urban concentrations outside of the South, especially among young people. And at this point, you also have a new leader, a new political and ideological leader who comes into the sort of mass awareness of Black America and of eventually white America too, as somebody who can articulate the grievances behind this wave of urban uprisings and to start to try and articulate a political approach that will appeal to this particular segment of the African-American population and the whole community. And that is Malcolm X, who is a minister in the Nation of Islam, which has for a long time up to this point been a very conservative and essentially apolitical organization. For a long, long time, there was a formal rule against members of the Nation of Islam being involved in politics. And their solution to the problems of racism and oppression in Black America was essentially a moral redemptive program whereby Black people would overcome the psychological and cultural and moral symptoms of living in a racist society on their own without basically changing the political circumstances, which is essentially in the hand of God. So that's the program of the Nation of Islam up to a certain point. But then Malcolm X starts to develop a more political version of this program. And Malcolm X begins to express a series of ideas that would ultimately be taken up after his assassination in 1965 by the Black Panther Party and by a younger generation of African-American militants. So I'm going to talk a little bit about what those ideas were because I think they're really important to understanding the Black Panther Party and its contribution. So the first three of these ideas can be grouped together, and those ideas are grouped together very immediately, and those ideas are self-determination, self-defense, and self-respect. Malcolm X talked about those things, the Black Panthers talked about those things. I'm going to pause and go into what each of those meant in a concrete sense in the situation of the Black Liberation Movement in America at this time. So self-determination basically meant what Seal explains in the 10-point program. We want the power to determine the future of our Black community. And there's this idea emerging that legal equality is not enough for Black Americans to solve the problems that they face. And relying on alliances with white liberals is no longer enough, especially when gains have been made in terms of formal equality, because white liberals are not interested in going any farther than granting Black people formal equality. So the idea emerges that for real lasting solutions to occur, Black people need to hold power where they live. They need to be in control of the places in which they live. And Malcolm X, in his really, really iconic speech, The Message to the Grassroots, talks about land and political power as being fundamental to the liberation of Black people. And within a few years, you'd have a really remarkable revival in the Black movement and the radical movement in America more generally of an idea that had previously been put forward by the Communist Party in the United States, which is that Black people were a nation with a national homeland in the South, and that they should exercise self-determination in that territory. The Black Panthers never exactly held that view, but it was one particular articulation of the idea of Black self-determination. The fundamental idea was that Black people need to have power over their own communities and the circumstances in which they existed for any real lasting solutions to be found. And the second is self-defense. And self-defense is probably the single issue that gets the most attention from white scholars and the white popular media. And there's this when looking at the Black Liberation Movement at this time, and there's this very entrenched framework of King and the pacifist Christian civil rights movement and Malcolm X and the Black Panthers who were violent. That's a really, really, really fundamental misrepresentation in a number of ways. In the first place, self-defense, including armed self-defense, was an essential part of the civil rights struggle in the South. It was an essential part of the freedom movement in the South. And in rural society in the southern United States, it's simply a fact that people are armed. And that included Black people as much as it included white people. And that was a necessary thing, because if you study the movement a bit, then you'll start to learn that even these struggles for formal and legal equality were faced with terrorism from the Klan, from other white racist terrorist organizations, and from the police. So people needed to protect themselves. The young, idealistic student activists who did have these pacifist convictions, white and Black, who went down to the South to register people to vote and to do this kind of work, could never have done it if they weren't being protected by the local rural Black people who were always armed and always ready and willing to protect themselves with arms. So, but then on another level, it's always been wrong to say that Malcolm X or the Black Panther Party or the militant section of the Black Liberation Movement in general has ever advocated violence, because they simply never advocated violence. What they always advocated was self-defense. And the basic fact of the matter is that white America and the American state are violent. The United States is a violent society, and the American state, of course, is an extraordinarily violent institution. King called the American state the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today. And he was, of course, right about that. And it's in that situation that a section of the African American movement was willing to politically say that it was necessary for Black people to defend themselves when they were being attacked. And if you look at the situation today with this enormous struggle going on around police brutality, there have actually been that call has actually reemerged in certain quarters to take up armed self-defense. And it's hard to see, it's not hard to see why that would when the police are the ones who are attacking Black communities. And it was a very, very similar situation, of course, that the Black Panther Party emerged out of. And they took up that program of self-defense in a very concrete way as Seale describes, and took up the work of attempting to defend black communities from racist police. So that's self-defense. It's always necessary to clear away the myths around violence and self-defense in the black liberation movement. And the third is self-respect. And this is very, very important. Because one aspect of the experience of racial or national oppression that it can be easy to lose sight of from the position of, you know, outside supporters or people who are sort of studying this in an abstract way, for those of us who don't experience it, is the psychological dimension and the internal dimension that has to do with the self-worth and the self-respect of oppressed people. And Malcolm X very, very forcefully advocated the reclaiming of dignity and self-worth for black Americans. And you can see where he drew on the program of the Nation of Islam there, because they believed very strongly and they attempted to put into practice building up the self-worth and the dignity of black Americans. Malcolm X basically took that and politicized it. And of course, there's this enormous cultural movement in black America at the same time. People began to change their names, rejecting slave names, rejecting Christianity. People took up what they imagined and at the same time sort of created forms of African culture, African dress and African names, especially Swahili mostly. And people took up Islam, both in the unorthodox forms of Nation of Islam and mainstream Sunni Islam, which of course Malcolm X turned to at the end of his life. And the Black Panthers, for the most part, were never really into that. Especially the leadership in Oakland, they were very, very secular people, and they called that kind of cultural movement, they referred to it as pork chop nationalism, specifically a reference to Islam, of course. And they didn't see that as being any kind of real solution or having any sort of real importance to the political struggle. But at the same time, if you look at the art of the Black Panther Party, the iconography of the Black Panther Party, and the way the images that the leaders, the leadership of the party, people like Newton and Seale and Cleaver were able to create for themselves, they were attempting at the same time as all this was going on to instill a sense of dignity and self-worth and pride in black Americans, especially in black American men. A lot of this was done in a very particularly gendered way. It was particularly geared toward men. But yeah, so that's the third point being self-respect. So those are three of the essential contributions that Malcolm X first articulated in a way and the Black Panther Party would later take up. And there are two more. One is connected to the idea of self-determination. And that gets into the issue of who are the African American people in the sense of what is the basic situation of this group of people and their relation to the rest of the society in which they live. And in the time of the Civil Rights Movement, as we've been discussing it, the political forces leading that movement, you know, people like King, had basically a conception of the African American people as a minority within American society who had been excluded from full participation in that society by unjust discrimination. But Malcolm X rejected that view entirely. And he said that black Americans were not effectively Americans at all. That they were a nation, a colonized nation, living within the borders of the United States, essentially kept within American society by force. And he – probably the most sort of popular way he expressed that, he said, we didn't land on Plymouth Rock. Plymouth Rock landed on us. And that gets at a historical truth, which is that people of African descent were never intended to be full members in American society. They were, of course, brought to the United States purely to serve as a slave labor force, and were only ever formally became citizens after the Civil War, after the United States had existed for decades as a nominally democratic society from which they were completely excluded. So there's a very strong historical basis to the argument that African Americans were never supposed to be included in this society. And the Black Panthers took that up. And they also took a very practical suggestion from Malcolm X and advocated it in their own turn, which is that the African-American people should go to the United Nations and demand that the United Nations organize a referendum in which the African-American people